Chapter 21. And reached their ears alone, and next day more than usual loud tread from a dancer would come the same way. With near approach these fragmentary sounds became pieced together, and were found to be the salient points of the tune called Ansie's Fancy. He was there, of course. Who was she that he danced with? Perhaps some unknown woman, far beneath herself in culture, was by the most subtle of lures sealing his fate this very instant. To dance with a man is to concentrate a 12-month's regulation fire upon him in the fragment of an hour. To pass to courtship without acquaintance, to pass to marriage without courtship, is a skipping of terms reserved for those alone who tread this royal road. She would see how his heart lay by keen observation of them all. The enterprising lady followed the mumming company through the gate in the white paling, and stood before the open porch. The house was encrusted with heavy thatchings, which dropped between the upper windows. The front, upon which the moonbeams directly played, had originally been white, but a huge pyracanth now darkened the greater portion. It became at once evident that the dance was proceeding immediately within the surface of the door, no apartment intervening. The brushing of skirts and elbows, sometimes the bumping of shoulders, could be heard against the very panels. Eustacia, though living within 2 miles of the place, had never seen the interior of this quaint old habitation. Between Captain Vi and the Yobrites there had never existed much acquaintance, the former having come as a stranger, and purchased the long empty house at Miss Tover Knapp not long before the death of Mrs. Yobright's husband. And with that event and the departure of her son such friendship as had grown up became quite broken off. Is there no passage inside the door, then? Asked Eustacia as they stood within the porch. No, said the lad who played the Saracen. He door opens right upon the front sitting room, where the spree's going on. So that we cannot open the door without stopping the dance. That's it. Here we must bide till they have done, for they always bolt the back door after dark. They won't be much longer, said Father Christmas. This assertion, however, was hardly borne out by the event. Again the instruments ended the tune, again they recommenced with as much fire and pathos, as if it were the first strain. The air was now that one without any particular beginning, middle, or end, which perhaps, among all the dances which throng an inspired fiddler's fancy, best conveys the idea of the interminable, the celebrated devil's dream. The fury of personal movement that was kindled by the fury of the notes could be approximately imagined by these outsiders under the moon, from the occasional kicks of toes and heels against the door, whenever the whirl round had been of more than customary velocity. The first 5 minutes of listening was interesting enough to the mummers. The 5 minutes extended to 10 minutes, and these to a quarter of an hour. But no signs of ceasing were audible in the lively dream. The bumping against the door, the laughter, the stamping, were all as vigorous as ever, and the pleasure in being outside lessened considerably. Why does Mrs. Eobright give parties of this sort? Eustacia asked, a little surprised to hear merriment so pronounced. It is not one of her bettermost parlor parties. She's asked the plain neighbors and workpeople without drawing any lines, just to give them a good supper and such like. Her son and she wait upon the folks. I see, said Eustacia. 'Tis the last strain, I think, said St. George, with his ear to the panel. Young man and woman have just swung into this corner, and he's saying to her, ah, the pity, 'tis over for us this time, my own. Apostrophe, thank God, said the Turkish knight, stamping, and taking from the wall the conventional lance that each of the mummers carried. Her boots being thinner than those of the young men, the whore had damped her feet, and made them cold. Upon my song, 'tis another 10 minutes for us, said the valiant soldier, looking through the keyhole as the tune modulated into another without stopping. Grandfer Cantle is standing in this corner, waiting his turn. 'Twan't be long, 'tis a six-handed reel, said the doctor. Why not go in, dancing or no? They sent for us, said the Saracen. Certainly not, said Eustacia authoritatively, as she paced smartly up and down from door to gate to warm herself. We should burst into the middle of them and stop the dance, and that would be unmannerly. He thinks himself somebody because he has had a bit more schooling than we, said the doctor. You may go to the deuce, said Eustacia. There was a whispered conversation between three or four of them, and one turned to her. Will you tell us one thing? He said, not without gentleness. Be you Miss Vi? We think you must be. You may think what you like, said Eustacia slowly. But honorable lads will not tell tales upon a lady. We'll say nothing, miss. That's upon our honor. Thank you, she replied. At this moment the fiddles finished off with a screech, and the serpent emitted a last note that nearly lifted the roof. When, from the comparative quiet within, the mummers judged that the dancers had taken their seats, Father Christmas advanced, lifted the latch, and put his head inside the door. Ah, the mummers, cried several guests at once. Clear a space for the mummers. Humpbacked Father Christmas then made a complete entry, swinging his huge club, and in a general way clearing the stage for the actors proper, while he informed the company in smart verse that he was come, welcome or welcome not, concluding his speech with, make room, my gallant boys, and give us space to rhyme. We've come to show St. George's play upon this Christmas time. The guests were now arranging themselves at one end of the room. The fiddler was mending a string. The serpent player was emptying his mouthpiece. And the play began. First of those outside, the valiant soldier entered. In the interest of St. George, here come I, the valiant soldier. Slasher is my name. And so on. This speech concluded with a challenge to the infidel, at the end of which it was Eustacia's duty to enter as the Turkish knight. She, with the rest who were not yet on, had hitherto remained in the moonlight which streamed under the porch. With no apparent effort or backwardness she came in, beginning, here come I, a Turkish knight, who learned in Turkish land to fight. I'll fight this man with courage bold. If his blood's hot I'll make it cold. During her declamation Eustacia held her head erect, and spoke as roughly as she could, feeling pretty secure from observation. But the concentration upon her part necessary to prevent discovery, the newness of the scene, the shine of the candles, and the confusing effect upon her vision of the ribboned visor which hid her features, left her absolutely unable to perceive who were present as spectators. On the further side of a table bearing candles she could faintly discern faces, and that was all. Meanwhile Jim Starks as the valiant soldier had come forward, and, with a glare upon the Turk, replied, F, then, thou art that Turkish knight, draw out thy sword, and let us fight. And fight they did. The issue of the combat, being that the valiant soldier was slain by a preternaturally inadequate thrust from Eustacia, Jim, in his ardor for genuine histrionic art, coming down like a log upon the stone floor with force enough to dislocate his shoulder. Then, after more words from the Turkish knight, rather too faintly delivered, and statements that he'd fight St. George and all his crew, St. George himself magnificently entered with the well-known flourish, here come I, St. George, the valiant man, with naked sword and spear in hand, who fought the dragon, and brought him to the slaughter, and by this one fair Sabra, the king of Egypt's daughter, what mortal man would dare to stand before me with my sword in hand? This was the lad who had first recognized Eustacia, and when she now, as the Turk, replied with suitable defiance, and at once began the combat, the young fellow took especial care to use his sword as gently as possible. Being wounded, the knight fell upon one knee according to the direction. The doctor now entered, restored the knight by giving him a draught from the bottle which he carried, and the fight was again resumed, the Turk sinking by degrees until quite overcome, dying as hard in this venerable drama as he is said to do at the present day. This gradual sinking to the earth was, in fact, one reason why Eustacia had thought that the part of the Turkish knight, though not the shortest, would suit her best. a direct fall from upright to horizontal, which was the end of the other fighting characters, was not an elegant or decorous part for a girl. But it was easy to die like a Turk, by a dogged decline. Eustacia was now among the number of the slain, though not on the floor, for as he had managed to sink into a sloping position against the clock case, so that her head was well elevated. The play proceeded between St. George, the Saracen, the Doctor, and Father Christmas, and Eustacia, having no more to do, for the first time found leisure to observe the scene round, and to search for the form that had drawn her hither. Six, the two stand face to face. The room had been arranged with a view to the dancing, the large oak table having been moved back till it stood as a breastwork to the fireplace. At each end, behind, and in the chimney corner were grouped the guests, many of them being warm-faced and panting, among whom Eustacia cursorily recognized some well-to-do persons from beyond the heath. Thomason, as he had expected, was not visible, and Eustacia recollected that a light had shone from an upper window when they were outside the window, probably, of Thomason's room. A nose, chin, hands, knees, and toes projected from the seat within the chimney opening, which members she found to unite in the person of Grandfer Cantle, Mrs. Eobright's occasional assistant in the garden, and therefore one of the invited. The smoke went up from an etna of peat in front of him, played round the notches of the chimney crook, struck against the salt box, and got lost among the flitches. Another part of the room soon riveted her gaze. At the other side of the chimney stood the settle, which is the necessary supplement to a fire so open that nothing less than a strong breeze will carry up the smoke. It is, to the hearths of old-fashioned cavernous fireplaces, what the east belt of trees is to the exposed country estate, or the north wall to the garden. Outside the settle candles gutter, locks of hair wave, young women shiver, and old men sneeze. Inside is paradise. Not a symptom of a draft disturbs the air. The sitters' backs are as warm as their faces, and songs and old tales are drawn from the occupants by the comfortable heat, like fruit from melon plants in a frame. It was, however, not with those who sat in the settle that Eustacia was concerned. A face showed itself with marked distinctness against the dark tanned wood of the upper part. The owner, who was leaning against the settle's outer end, was Clement Eobright, or Clem, as he was called here. She knew it could be nobody else. The spectacle constituted an area of 2 feet in Rembrandt's intensest manner. A strange power in the lounger's appearance lay in the fact that, though his whole figure was visible, the observer's eye was only aware of his face. To one of middle age the countenance was that of a young man, though a youth might hardly have seen any necessity for the term of immaturity. But it was really one of those faces which convey less the idea of so many years as its age than of so much experience as its store. The number of their years may have adequately summed up Jared, Mahalalel, and the rest of the antediluvians, but the age of a modern man is to be measured by the intensity of his history. The face was well shaped, even excellently. But the mind within was beginning to use it as a mere waste tablet whereon to trace its idiosyncrasies as they developed themselves. The beauty here visible would in no long time be ruthlessly overrun by its parasite, thought, which might just as well have fed upon a plainer exterior where there was nothing it could harm. Had heaven preserved Eobright from a wearing habit of meditation, people would have said. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.